we can probably get started. I don't know how many of you were here last week when we talked about science blogging, but I'll just reiterate that if any of you want to play around with the tool of the science blog, just email me your email address. I'll sign you up and you'll get a little email invitation saying, you know, welcome, and then you just fill out a little field. And then you can post and write and do whatever you want and play around with the blog. We are not making it, you know, technically public. It's out there, but we are not advertising or broadcasting, so you do have some freedom there. Some guy already went on, Tom Prince already went on and posted some really great pictures of KITP that he took in the infrared. Looks really awesome. So I hope that you will check that out. Next week, we're going to have a very special event. It's going to be held in the small seminar room, but I have David Salzberg from UCLA coming up. He's a theoretical physicist there, and, or experimental physicist there, and he is the technical consultant for the Big Bang Theory sitcom. And he's going to be joined by David Gray, a TV writer, and they're going to talk about the interaction between scientists in Hollywood. And what we hope to do at the very end, what we hope to do at the very end is kind of create our little mini writer's room for about a half an hour or 40 minutes and just kind of brainstorm and get the feel of what goes on in a writer's room and how they come up with their ideas and how scientists can interact. And hopefully we'll be able to come up with our own idea for a TV series based on physics, or at least we hope. We figure numbers has been doing so well. Let's get something going on with physics. Today, though, we're going to talk about some. Yeah. Numbers is on Friday nights at 10? No, the Big Bang Theory is a sitcom, and it's on hiatus at the moment because of the writer's strike. It's just starting to gear up again. It's a fairly new show. Oh, do they? They have it online. And if you actually, you know, people who've seen the promos kind of are, you know, it just looked like a bunch of geeky physicists drooling over the hot blonde kind of premise. And okay, that's part of it. But if you look at the blackboards in the background, all the equations are correct. They're often taken from David Salzberg's class that week or whatever he's working on. The technical dialogue is actually very accurate. There's this great scene where they're trying to get something up a stair and they actually, you know, talk about, you know, the equation for the slope of an inclined plane. And so it's very, very useful.
Which program is this, Numbers or a different
one? No, this is called The Big Bang Theory. It's actually a sitcom. You almost never see that in a sitcom. So I'm very excited that they're going to be here next week. They're coming up gratis, so I hope people will show up for that. Today we're talking about a very different kind of interaction, press conference protocol. Whether or not you realize it, chances are at some point in your career you might be asked to be a presenter or participate in some form of press conference. I actually think more and more this should be part of, there should be like little workshops or seminars that should be required for postdocs in preparing them for their careers, because so many scientists end up being asked to do these press conferences at scientific conferences and so few of them receive any preparation. Making sure the media gets the message is the subtitle here, and that's really key. That's why press conferences are so important, because this is our chance, or your chance as the scientist, to tailor the message as much as possible. You can't necessarily control what this journalist then goes out and chooses to write, but in as much as you can frame the message and tailor it specifically and say exactly what you want to say, you can emphasize the points you want to emphasize, the press conference is great for that. It is a very specific format, which I was just explaining to BC here. It is designed primarily for print and TV, short attention span journalism, I like to call it, basically daily newspapers and things. So the format is very specific. Has some very specific requirements. More than ever, you've got to really prepare your message beforehand. You've got to be short, sharp, to the point, and you've really got to drive your main points home. I'm going to show you a fun little clip. About a press conference. This is from an internet phenomenon called Mr. Deity. It's basically a short mock TV series. And this one, special for the Super Bowl, Mr. Deity is preparing for a press conference with his little Trinity. Can everybody see that? Okay, move it up.
How does it look out there?
Oh, it's a good crowd. What did you do?
How about them Cowboys?
I said Colts.
Sir, I told him
no,
you said Colts.
Told me Cowboys.
I sent you the email last night.
You told me Cowboys.
You said America's Cowboys aren't even in the Super Bowl.
You said America's team.
All right, all right.
Okay, which jersey do you want? We got them all. We can
change. You'll come back as Lakers next time. We don't have time.
Genius. Thanks.
We're going out. You got to stay off the left. Always on my right. Always on my right.
Wait, sir, you mean on your right?
Of course his
Who's right. Whose right would it be?
It's his stage right. Have you ever done a play?
Come on, you're
theater.
The stage
That's
right.
What I
my right, my
yes,
right.
Sir.
All right, everyone, snuggle up.
Sir, huddle up.
Huddle up. Right. Okay, I got to be on top. All right, ready? In the name of the
deity, the boy, and Larry, sanctification.
All right.
Sir, he blinked me.
Did not.
Shut up!
I want to say something to the American people. I want you to listen. I'm going to say this again. I did not have... Oh, sorry. I'm kidding. Thank you all for coming. I have a brief written statement, after which I'll take a few questions. Every year around this time, I'm plagued by people asking me to help their favorite sports team or sports personality. Quite frankly, the presumption is ludicrous. I do not help one team over any other, nor do I help professional athletes in any... No, that wasn't me. No, stupid jury. Oh, okay. I did help Kobe, but that was such a he said, she said kind of thing, and I love watching the kid play, so what was I going to do? But I digress. The point is, when you thank me for helping you, the implication is that I didn't help the other guy. The truth is, if you won, you either deserve to win, got lucky, or perhaps it was fate. Is fate here? Was she able to make it? Fate?
Okay.
All right. The same is true for natural disasters, earthquakes, floods, tsunamis. I think that's the compliment.
Right.
I do not save your schmuck brother-in-law with the kiddie porn collection in the shed and let the mother of seven die. That's just not how I roll. Who let the dogs out? Finally, and this I cannot stress enough, people, you have to floss regularly, okay? Do this little experiment. Next time you brush, floss afterwards and see how much gunk you still get out. It's disgusting. A healthy mouth is a clean body. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You said you'd take questions.
Is that a question? Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to analyze Mr. Deity's press conference here. He did a lot right. First of all, it was very clear when you're watching this that they did some press work with his peeps. I mean, they talked about presentation. They tried to get the right uniforms. Didn't go perfectly because, you know, Larry doesn't quite get the team straight. But, you know, he worked with, okay, you're going to stand on my right, that sort of thing. Really thought about how it was going to come across. So he paid attention to appearances and staging. He opened with a joke, a bit of levity to loosen the crowd. That's classic. Anytime you notice this all the time for speakers who are giving talks, even at scientific conferences, they at least try to show something at the very beginning. And I did it here. It's actually a very, very good way to relax everybody, including the speaker, because most of us are always a little, you know, wired and a little uptight when we first start. So it basically does everyone a service to open up with that. He gave the context, basically saying every time, this time of year, people keep asking me to help their team. And then he outlined the problem and he addressed it in a very, very quick, short, prepared statement. He had a little trademark gesture. Nixon's little thing that he was so known for back in the 70s was actually very, very calculated. It was designed, you know, specifically to make him seem kind of cool and hip. And you see kind of Mr. Deity making the hip-hop version of that rather badly. But nonetheless, he tried. And most importantly, he kept it short. He kept it to, you know, under 10 minutes, which, believe it or not, is about what you want in a press conference. Remember that there's only so much information that you can convey before someone's brain shuts down. This is particularly true of a reporter for a daily newspaper. They're on a very tight deadline. This is probably the third thing they've covered today. And if, unless they're specifically assigned to a physics beat, they're going to be just covering global warming, nanotechnology, and theoretical physics all in the same day, and possibly a short political policy, you know, article that they're working on long term. Try and keep that in mind next time you get a little frustrated with reporters that, particularly when they work for daily newspapers or wire services, they're really doing a very delicate juggling act. They don't have a lot of time. The more you can do to help them get the message straight, get your main points across, that core narrative we talked about in the first workshop, all these things really help. What Mr. Deity did wrong? Well, he lost focus on the Kobe question. You know, he started to make a very, very strong point, and then he kind of hedged and backpedaled because his advisors kept pointing stuff out. Technically, this may be correct, but notice that it kind of complicates the issue and it dilutes the message. And what you couldn't see was that there was a news ticker running along and kind of in real time picking up what he was saying in his statement, and they promptly jumped on the Kobe thing. And he kind of, as a result, that kind of diluted the point he was trying to make, which is he does not interfere. Same thing is true when you do this in a scientific press conference. There may be a small detail that might be relevant, but if it's just a kind of a side note or a sideline, you risk derailing your message. And what can often happen is the reporter gets hung up on the sideline, misses the main message, and you end up with a really bizarre, skewed kind of coverage. Then we went off on a very weird tangent about flossing. I agree with him about flossing, but still, not the place. And finally, he didn't really take questions, and that really is one of the points of the press conference. When I say 10 minutes, I mean that should be your presentation. What you want to do is get the main points, the core narrative, and basically the two or three things that you really want to emphasize out there, and then let them worry about what they want to know more about. You will also, by the way, always have press materials if you're very, very well organized, and we'll talk about that a little later. So, Mr. Deity, not perfect, but, you know, he's the deity. He's likable, he's amiable. People are going to forgive him quite a lot, in part because of that personality thing. He really does know how to connect to his audience. I'm going to compare that. I don't know if any of you know the TV series Bones. They had a rerun just last week or a couple weeks ago. Bones features a female scientist who specializes essentially in studying the bones of, you know, corpses and things that have shown up, trying to help identify them and what they died of and that sort of thing, helping the FBI solve crimes. It's, again, basic cop story, but with a scientific angle. She's called upon to testify in a trial, a couple who's on trial for murdering a young woman. And she is the expert witness. And there is a witness consultant there, an expert witness consultant, who basically tells her, we can't put you on the stand. You can't connect with the jury. You're cold. You're aloof. You're way too technical. You know, and you're basically just stripping this of all the emotional content. And in fact, that is exactly what happens. Temperance gets on the stand and proceeds to run through all the facts of the case in very careful, scientific, very, you know, technical terms. And the attorney who's questioning her, who is actually the friendly attorney, has to keep stopping her to explain things. And at one point, you know, she says something very technical, and he says, so essentially her wrist broke because she was trying to get free of handcuffs. She goes, yes, I believe I just said that, you know, in a very kind of condescending term. And then the other expert witness is very likable. He's good looking. He puts things in plain English. He's for the defense. And essentially what happens is the jury consultant says, you know, those killers are going to get off because she can't connect. Rarely do we get a case like that. This is TV, obviously. But it does illustrate a very, very fundamental problem. That when we rely on what we're comfortable with, the way we normally talk to colleagues, we actually don't manage to make any kind of connection with our listeners. And particularly when you're talking to the public or to a reporter, you've got to have that. Because if you don't make that connection, then no real communication can take place. In the end, of course, this is TV, and Brennan, the lawyer, figures out a way to break through her veneer. And she ends up being able to at least make the victim become real to them and her suffering become real to the jury, and they convict. But it's very interesting because she's basically complaining to her boss that the jury likes the other guy more than her, and she says, I don't understand why this should be the case. Why should this be relevant? It should be about the facts, about the science, and the facts clearly show that this couple is guilty. And he says, well, you know, but for people, you know, for people on the, you know, in the jury, I mean, it matters. They have to actually, you know, connect. She goes, are they stupid? And he says, well, compared to you, maybe, you know, but compared to you, most people are stupid. But it was a great episode in that it illustrated how important that is. Now, that's a TV show, and rarely do verdicts rest on something like that because, you know, most juries can, in fact, in the end, overlook their personal dislike. But if scientists don't speak up, if they don't participate in press conferences, if they don't try at least to take control of the message, then they risk losing control of the message. That's going to affect how the science gets covered. And we end up with something like this. This was actually a sentence or two in an article in Salon in 2006. String theory says that these seemingly amorphous, infinitesimal aspects of matter are made from other dimensions compressed to a smallness that strains imagination. This is by a writer called Greg Easterbrook, who has quickly become known in my field as one of the worst working science writers out there. He's technically a sports writer, but he's decided that he can work science into his sports copy. In the same article, he also said that quarks don't have content. And the entire gist of the argument was he was trying to use string theory as a basis to support intelligent design and creationism. There was so much wrong with that article, it just made me cringe. Clearly, he didn't even watch the Nova special with Brian Greene. Or if he did, he didn't grasp very much of it. But this was a case where, you know, he didn't get enough useful input in a language he could understand. Chances are you might not have been able to help him. Someone who's trying to warp string theory to kind of prove his own ends is probably not going to be open to it, but it is a very good illustration of just how bad the coverage can get. My first experience as a budding young science writer in April 1992 was at an APS April meeting. And it gave me a rather skewed sense of what scientific press conferences were like, because that was the year they announced the COBE results, which Stephen Hawking has called the greatest discovery of the century, if not all time. So I walk into, whether or not you agree with that is beside the point, I walk in to this press conference. They had this huge room. There are television cameras from every single major network, ABC, NBC, CNN, all these. There's radio and print reporters. There's literally about 200 different press people there, and everything, you know, lots of press materials, lots of really cool graphics, including, you know, this one, kind of explaining it, breaking it all down. And it gave me a very, very skewed idea, because this was a perfectly done, very professional press conference. They had brought in technical consultants. Everyone was interested. It made every single major newspaper. It was probably the biggest science news of the year in 1992. And of course it built on an earlier discovery that I didn't remember because I was not even cognizant of physics at the time, but my husband actually remembers very, very well, which was, you know, measuring the black body radiation, the cosmic background radiation, and finding that it was in fact indeed a perfect black body curve. And these two combinations of work were of course honored with the 2006 Nobel Prize in Physics. Those kind of results don't come along every day in science. Science doesn't really have these kind of big dramatic announcements on a daily basis, which does not mean that we don't have a lot of important things going on all the time. The problem becomes, how do we convince people of this? Alas, most press conferences, they are not nearly as exciting. And most of these that I'm talking about, I've actually blogged about, so my opinions are public, and I feel very comfortable talking to you about them, even though, you know, they're not always flattering. This is what blogs are actually good for. I complained about this particular press conference on my blog, and I ended up getting some very, very good feedback from condensed matter physicists. Condensed matter physics, in particular, has a very, very serious image problem in the press. It's very difficult to get across to people the excitement of this. In general, what they do is they latch onto like a practical application because it's the only thing they can think of, because otherwise you're trying to describe these obscure quantum effects and materials behavior and things like that. But in this case, it was actually a very exciting breakthrough. We had these two-dimensional carbon sheets, graphene, which previously had been thought to be purely theoretical, and a year or two before, a couple of different research teams in different parts of the world had succeeded in actually constructing these sheets of graphene. In particular, it promised to be a major contender to carbon nanotubes for the future of nanoscale electronics, because you can get much more better control. Carbon nanotubes are great, but you know, things like shape and size and orientation all have to be perfectly matched and oriented in order to get good control over the properties. They're good for, say, reinforcing structural things like cement bridges, because you don't need that kind of precise control, but for electronics, yeah, you really do. So you'd think you had a big breakthrough, and then you also had, you know, an actual practical application. How did the press respond? This is pretty much like this. The guy, you know, they were falling asleep, they were blanking out, they were just kind of going through the motions. They weren't excited at all. why, what went wrong. And what I basically said was the presenters were just, first of all, they were way, way too technical. These are just a few of the jargony phrases that I jotted down in my notes because it became very clear to me that, you know, I needed to call them out on this. The quantum Hall effect, the Klein paradox, Barry's phase, the Aronov-Bohm effect, fine structure constant, superconducting field effect transistors, which are probably the most accessible, but still most people don't know what an FET is. None of these were even, they didn't even bother to define these for the reporters that were present. Rule number one is don't assume knowledge that isn't there, and they just, you know, and they had been prompted, they had been like prepped for this, and they just kind of, they got nervous, they got in front of their peers, and they just started talking, you know, in what I call a technological Tourette's. I mean, even I couldn't follow it, and I had actually done a story about graphene the year before. I had to basically sit there and translate in my head to try and figure out what they were talking about. It was that poorly done. So I blogged about this, and I complained. I said, well, why couldn't you just say, you know, that the electrons in graphene kind of zip along at the speed of light as if they had no mass, even though they do, and this contradicts special relativity, blah, 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 and that faster moving electrons eventually means less resistance, which means faster electronics. That's really all you needed to say. So a guy in Switzerland, I think he's now back in the U.S., named Peter Armitage, who's a condensed matter theorist, responded, and he says, well, you know, part of the problem is scientists are asked to emphasize applications all the time, and because frankly, it's not what we're most excited about graphene. And I think that that's a very valid point. I think that sometimes we get a little lazy on the application angle. Because it's the easiest way to tie in, we take that shortcut and we try and find the application. When in fact, I think you can sell a story like graphene on the basic science. But it's a lot harder to do. And I think that, and this is an example of how, because I said, well, Peter, how would you put it? And this is what he told me. he said, the electrons in graphene are described by the same formalism that applies to the relativistic particles of the Dirac equation. One can simulate the rich structure of elementary particle physics in a tabletop experiment. Now, I think I could probably work with that last sentence, but I guarantee you that most of us, you know, can't like pop off the Dirac equation right off the bat. Some people have never even heard of Dirac, believe it or not. I actually had to go look up the Dirac equation, and it still didn't help because a lot of the technical definitions aren't that great. And, you know, he pointed out that, well, I put an exclamation point at the end of my sentence, and I went, that's really not going to be sufficient. But he tried. So graphene, unfortunately, fell victim to technological Tourette's. It did get covered. It's a big, major science story, but it got covered in Science, Nature, Physics World, Physics Today, basically the science trade press. And this fantastic story about this great new material kind of got lost in the shuffle. And it's too bad because there was a lot of different angles they could have played, one of which came out with one of the researchers was Walt Dehier of Georgia Tech, who basically, he had a great personal story where all his colleagues 10 years before had been all excited and working on carbon nanotubes, and he said, I think there are some serious problems here when we come to trying to use these for nanoelectronics, and I think we should be looking into other forms of carbon. I think we should be looking into this theoretical graphene. And he couldn't get funding for it because all the NSF proposals everything was all about carbon nanotubes. Intel finally took pity on him, funded his research, and now, of course, he's funded by both Intel and NSF. And for Intel's sake, I hope it pays off for them, even though, I mean, obviously this is fundamental research and we still have a very, very long way to go. So there was also this great human interest angle, among other things. And had I been reporting on that for the general media, I might have latched onto that as well as kind of a jumping off point to kind of make it relevant, to try and connect, you know, what Temperance Brennan couldn't do with the jury. Last year, we had the mini Boone results at the 2007 APS April meeting, and I was just blown away. In fact, having criticized a press conference the prior year on my blog, I basically said, you know, credit where credit is due, and I wrote a whole blog post on everything they did right. The presenters were Janet Conrad, Heather Ray, and Eric Zimmerman. What they did right. They basically built their case block by block, and they started out broadly. They said, okay, let's talk about what are neutrinos? Where do they fit in the standard model? What is the standard model, which, believe it or not, you do have to explain to people. And then also you want to talk a little bit about the history of the solar neutrino problem, which is, you know, that, you know, we were expecting a certain number of neutrinos, we couldn't find them, they were missing, and then we found out that in fact the neutrinos were oscillating on their way to the Earth, and that changed how we counted them. So then we had to discuss what are neutrino oscillations, and Janet Conrad came up with a fantastic demonstration. She brought in two tuning forks with matching frequencies, and to one she essentially tied a tiny bit of mass, and then she struck each one so you could listen to the tones that they produced, and the one with the mass you could clearly hear this wah, wah, wah thing happening. So reporters could actually hear the oscillation in the tone, and she could then say, this is like what is happening to the neutrinos. This is how we know that neutrinos at least have some small amount of mass, because up to that point, it had been believed that they were massless particles, much like photons. They described the experiment, not just how it was set up and not just the various parts, but also what they were looking for specifically and exactly how the experiment was going to help them look for that. They had a very, very clear result, which they were able to describe in very clear, concise, and mostly jargon-free language. When you're dealing with something of this magnitude, of course, you're not going to be able to avoid technical terms altogether. When they couldn't avoid using them, they very, very carefully defined them, and they also had some very relevant press packets, and one of the things in that press packet was a glossary of terms that essentially reporters could go back to after the press conference and do their own fact checking. That's one thing to remember if you're frustrated by these short 10-minute presentations. That is not the whole thing. You also give them the background information so that they can check it at their leisure later when they get back to their desk. The press conference is designed to get out the basic message, set the stage, here's what we found, here's why it's important, here's why you should report on it, and then the reporters can ask some quick questions to liven up their copy. Then they go and they're back to the desk and they fill in the technical details later. So press kits are very, very, very important. And finally, they described the implications of the results and also their plans for future experiments, the kind of, well, what's next? Now that we've figured this out, you know, what didn't we quite get right? What are we going to do next in order to refine that? Again, in as plain of English as possible, and when they couldn't avoid using technical terms, they had to very carefully define everything.
How long did they have to make this pitch?
Each presenter had 5 to 10 minutes, so there were three of them. So let's say that was about 30 minutes, and they took questions and answers for about another 15. It was one of the longer press conferences because it was a major result. But again, each presenter had their 10 minutes. And you know that what Janet Conrad did was, you know, she had to very, very quickly explain in a very short period of time what neutrino oscillations are like, and she had to give them something very tangible. I loved the tuning fork analogy. These are not perfect analogies, obviously, for anyone who actually works on neutrinos, but you've really just kind of got to give them a visual, some sort of idea that they can latch onto. So I hope this should tell you why scientists should care about press conferences, in particular for anyone here who's at all affiliated with the LHC. In terms of high energy and particle physics, from here on out, once that thing turns on, it's going to be all LHC all the time. And once those results start coming in, there's going to be a great deal of media interest. So there's a very good chance, if you are affiliated with one of the major experiments or projects, or even if you're a theorist whose work can provide the relevant context, that you're going to be asked at some point to either speak to the media or to participate in a press conference. That includes theorists. Again, as I pointed out, we absolutely need you to provide key context for the discoveries. The first talk that I gave here, it became very, very clear that although there's been a lot of very good media outreach in terms of establishing, you know, what the LHC does and what it's looking for, that in fact the theoretical aspects have not gotten through, you know, even to someone like me. So this is something that I think that needs to happen. Once we start getting these results, we're not going to be able to explain the significance of those results without the theorists stepping in and figuring out how to connect with the layperson and talk about their, you know, why the theory, how the theory connects essentially to the experimental results. Do you really need to hold a press conference? That's a very, very good question. When I was preparing this talk, I sent out emails to all my friends who are public information officers at various universities and national labs. It happened to coincide with the AAAS meeting, so about a dozen of them got together and brainstormed, and I got some of the best All the stuff that you're seeing from here on out is from them, what they want. And actually, one of the first things they said was, you know, sometimes a press conference isn't necessary. Sometimes a press release will suffice. For instance, is there any real news? Is there a reportable result? And is holding a press conference really to your benefit? I don't know if you remember Bloom County, but they had an imaginary newspaper. And here, of course, you have them making fun of NASA. You know, we're proud to announce the launching into space next week of America's first Italian Elvis impersonator with a lisp. So that's really not news, apart from like a joke news. But I want to show a clip from The Daily Show, which I hope will work. Yeah, here we go. That kind of illustrates this point a little better. There we go. This was when they thought the asteroid was going to hit. And I'm sorry that we can't see this better.
News with headlines.
Ah.
Astronomers in New Mexico are keeping a close watch on a 1.5-mile-wide asteroid discovered earlier this month that they believe could collide with Earth, causing a global catastrophe.
Or not. There's a good chance it won't. But if it did, oh boy! But it won't. Who knows? Initial calculations indicate there is a remote possibility the asteroid, known as 2002 NT7, will collide with Earth on February 1st, 2019, devastating nations, sending 500-foot mountains of water barreling into shorelines, and undoubtedly ruining the 81st birthday party for Sherman Hemsley. True, you can look it up. That's going to be his 81st birthday. And if the asteroid hits, it's going to be a bad birthday. Now, the asteroid is only 1.5 miles wide, not even big enough for some kind of Rhode Island size comparison. So just how bad could the damage really be?
It's 1 million tons of TNT, which is like something like 100 Hiroshima bombs.
That's pretty bad. All right, so if it hits, it will be bad, but really, what are the chances? NASA gives the asteroid a rating of 1 on the Torino Impact Hazard Scale, meaning it's an event meriting monitoring. The Torino Impact Scale is a color-coded chart ranging from 0, an event having no practical consequence, all the way up to... Is it possible to pull a lung? The exact amount of devastation would depend on where the asteroid hit. If the asteroid hit land, it could cause a cloud of debris. On water, a tidal wave. And no one can predict the kind of agony that would result were the Earth to take one right in the Balkans. The Galapagos, I mean. All told, the odds of the asteroid striking the Earth are about 1 in 250,000, so. Said one skeptic. If we do in fact have to deal with a potential impact, there are several ways that we can prevent it.
If you've got this suitable spacecraft, you can fly there and put a little rocket motor on it.
Rocket motor on the asteroid. Check.
Funnily enough, you can almost literally go there and paint it white, because that'll change the way it absorbs light from the sun, and that will gradually change its path.
Okay, fly to asteroid, paint it white. Check.
You can attach a solar sail, which is a big piece of aluminium foil that collects light from the sun and just gently pushes the asteroid slowly off course.
Now you just make up. Or you can put on a hat and eat a tangerine and it'll just go away.
I bring that up just because it's a very, very good example of probably when it's not a good idea to hold a press conference. I mean, if you know, asteroid may hit, it may not. It could be bad, it could be not. It's kind of a non-story in that respect. And what The Daily Show is making fun of is a little bit bad, you know, the fact that they kind of turned it into a non-story, you know. But if it does, it'll be really bad, but it probably won't, you know. So you really do want to ask yourself whether this is really worth having a news conference. I mean, you know, will it get the Daily Show treatment? Will people overreact? This is particularly, I think, important with the LHC. Believe me, you know, when you start giving these press conferences, the first question that's going to be asked is, are you going to create a black hole that destroys the world? You know, because you know that's going to come up. So be prepared.
Always
so. And you're going to have to be able to explain why. You've decided, okay, we want to hold a press conference. Now you got to do the prep work. And fortunately for the scientists, you actually don't have to do most of this. This generally is the job of the PIO and, you know, the director of the project, director of the lab, whatever. You got to decide who the speakers are going to be, who will best represent this particular scientific result. And it's not necessarily the biggest names, although media, like anyone else, they're a sucker for the big names. So it's good to at least have, you know, one token Nobel laureate if you can get them. Length of presentation, as I said, you've really got to keep it to 5 to 10 minutes. Be very, very careful that you answer all the key questions, because journalists are pretty much trained to focus on who, what, when, where, how, and why, to the exclusion of all else. And again, we're talking specifically about, you know, daily newscasts, you know, the press, the radio, the newspapers. Try to anticipate additional questions like, will the LHC destroy the world? Decide what will be the technical level of the presentation, who's going to be there. Is it going to be primarily science press, and you want it to be primarily science press, then you can raise the ante a little bit. You can up the level of discourse. What kinds of graphics and pictures can be used? That's very, very important. I remember the American Physical Society, when the top quark was discovered, they were trying to come up with basically a nice little picture explaining why this was important and where it fit into the standard model and that sort of thing. And one of the people at Fermilab says, oh, I've got the perfect thing, a perfect thing, and I'll send it off right to you. And he sent it off to us, and we looked at it, and finally one of the guys went, you know, I have a PhD in physics, and I can't figure out what they're trying to tell me here. And he was a high-energy physicist. It was just so poorly organized. So be careful about the kinds of graphics that you choose and make sure they're actually conveying information and they're not confusing the issue further. You want to decide whether the press conference will be taped, and in this age that includes webcasting, podcasting, all of that. It's often a very good idea to do this. More and more you can sometimes get reporters calling in, but if there's any kind of time difficulty, if the press conference is happening in Los Angeles and someone in London wants to cover it, it can be very difficult. So sometimes taping them and then, or webcasting them, posting them on the web is actually a very good thing to do. A little bit of extra work in terms of prep, but it can be worth it. You want to give the media sufficient advance notice. The day before is probably not a good idea, unless you're trying to hide something. This actually happened with the Lucent Bell Labs when they had that issue of fraud with Henrik Schön. They actually did have a hearing, a press conference about this, and they very, very carefully did not let the reporters know until literally like 3 hours beforehand, because it was very embarrassing for them. Somehow the New York Times figured it out and got there ahead of time. And then you want to assemble any pertinent handout materials. Remember, I told you these are also very, very important, because this is what the reporters are going to use when they get back to their desk to kind of fill in the blanks. When we talked about core narrative in the first workshop, I said that what you want to do is boil it down to the essential elements, and then you can layer the technical detail on top of that. That's exactly what a reporter is doing. What he wants from you in the press conference is those core elements, and then you'll kind of give him the material that he can build on top of that. And the Q&A is designed so that he can ask some pertinent questions and get some lively quotes. So, reporters are looking for narratives, which is why I really focused on that in that first talk. They want it to be timely, either have a news hook, such as a new paper or a new result, or a tie-in with current events. When I asked Phil Shuey of the American Institute of Physics, who does a lot of the APS press conferences, you know, how he preps his scientists, he says, well, he goes, I always tell them that they need a reportable result and needs to be upfront. You know, this is what we found, this is why it's important. He goes, as you know, having attended many of my press conferences, the reportable result does not always emerge. But that's the idea. You want it to be fairly broad in scope. In other words, you want to somehow relate it in such a way that people think it's relevant to them. That does not mean necessarily, you know, will this give me a faster, a better iPod? It can also, you know, be something that they recognize. You know, why does my cereal snap, crackle, and pop? There's actually a very interesting science answer to that. It's very possible to find some creative angle there that kind of makes people realize that it somehow affects their lives in some way. So you want an angle. This can be almost anything. Remember I told you that had I been covering the graphene, I probably would have gone with the human interest story with Walt Dehier just because it's such a nice narrative. And then kind of in the context of that, work in the technical discussion of why graphene is so important in terms of material science. Now, this is actually something I don't necessarily agree with, but I recognize the truth of it. Stories that reflect conflict. Conflict is the backbone of most reporting. It is less relevant, I think, to science reporting, and I think we have to be very, very careful when we speak to the press and we present science to the press, not to play into that. It's very, very, very easy for a small disagreement among scientists to get blown out of proportion and turn into the string wars if you're not very careful. And of course, the press ate up the string wars. They absolutely loved it. It was conflict. It got reported ad nauseum to the point where it actually ended up really causing harm to the science community. They also want something that demonstrates human drama, compelling characters. Again, I liked the whole, you know, Walt Dehier thing because, you know, he was a character. He was human. He had basically, you know, believed in graphene when nobody really thought it had any promise because it was just theoretical and no one thought they would ever be able to make this two-dimensional sheet of carbon, but in fact, they did. So those are the things, those are kind of the elements that reporters are looking for. These, by the way, are all from Jason Bardee, who was with NIH and is now with the American Institute of Physics. And I do think he's right, even about the conflict. I just, you know, would like to see less of that aspect in a lot of the science reporting that goes along. So, tips for presenters. Be well groomed, although I would add, don't be afraid to show some individual style. I do want to note that TV has some very special requirements. Any kind of busy prints and things like that really don't work well on camera. There's just something happens in the translation, and it's a big old mess. We're actually going to be doing a television workshop where we are actually going to be taping people on camera, talking, doing taped interviews, essentially one-on-one interviews with an interviewer and a subject, and then we'll play it back, and people can kind of get an idea of how they're coming across. But that is extremely helpful. The first time that I actually did that, I was appalled. It's like, oh my God, my hair. You know, what was I doing with my hands? Why did I choose to wear that shirt? Nothing brings it home as seeing yourself on camera. And I've always been one of those people that felt that, well, I'm a writer. Why should anyone care how I dress? To the point I once met a friend for dinner, and she looked me over. She goes, I have a question. When you left the house this evening, what the hell were you thinking? I've improved in that regard. I have to actually work at it. In general, I dress for comfort, and I think most scientists would follow me. But when you publish a couple of books and suddenly you're making personal appearances, you've got to start paying attention to that. And it's made me much more aware of just simple, you know, neatness, which colors work, which don't. Something that looks great that you love is not going to work well on camera. Don't wear it. The other thing, stand or sit straight. Don't jiggle, fidget, or swivel in a chair. And to be aware of unconscious gestures. I did Blogging Heads TV a couple of times now, and the first time I had a swivel chair, and I caught myself, you know, in the first 10 minutes, I was just kind of going, wee, while I was talking, and it looks really bad. I mean, first of all, no one can see the chair. They just see you kind of moving back and forth. It's like, and you want to be aware of those sorts of things. They're nervous tics. Every time I went to brush hair out, I blocked my face with my hand, things like that. Things that you don't think about. They're kind of unconscious gestures, but they show up on camera. The camera is unforgiving. We already discussed, decide on two or three main points as the key messages, and you want to keep your statement simple, brief, and to the point. Don't get blown off on tangents. Save that for the Q&A. I want to make sure we have time. Good. Now, we've already discussed the jargon issue. You're not going to be able to avoid it altogether with some of this stuff. We're dealing with some very, very advanced scientific work, particularly when you're dealing with physics theory. Just make sure that when you do use jargon that it's carefully defined. You basically just build your case block by block and, you know, to build up your message and get your point across. During the Q&A, believe it or not, avoid speculation. Don't answer the hypothetical questions, and they will ask you the hypothetical questions. This is not because, you know, you're afraid to hypothesize or speculate, because particularly theorists, you know, you love to speculate. That's what you do. The problem is the reporters will latch onto your speculation, I guarantee it, and they will miss what is actually the real science, and they will play up the speculation. That one little off-the-cuff comment that you make is what they're going to end up focusing on in their article. So you want to be very, very careful how you answer those hypothetical questions. Just basically say, I'd really prefer not to speculate. You want to avoid inflammatory statements, like, you know, talking down another scientist or another experiment, or basically, the string wars basically came about because, you know, certain scientists were rather inflammatory in their statements. They were colorful, the press ate it up, but it ended up causing a lot more trouble. It played right into that whole, you know, lust for blood, you know, the whole conflict. Don't be afraid of dead air. This is actually very, very hard to learn. It makes me very, very nervous if I'm the only one, if I'm talking to someone and suddenly there's like this uncomfortable silence. You have to kind of know someone fairly well before you actually feel comfortable with that. But as the person who is being interviewed or as the presenter, you do not want to jump in and fill that silence, because you will say something that you did not prepare. You will say something that might be off the cuff, that you would prefer to be off the record. And again, the chances that they will latch on to that are very, very good. So you don't really want to jump in and fill the silence. It's their job. Let them do it. Just sit there and stare at them. You'll unnerve them. It'll be fun. Try and be confident, calm, courteous, and engaging. I'm shocked at how many scientists basically get up there and speak in a monotone, and you take them aside afterwards, and they're fun, and they're lively, and they're cracking jokes, and you know, they talk in completely different tones than they do when they're giving a presentation.
I've had people say to me, I have trouble walking the line between enthusiasm and self-promotion.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And they don't want to appear to be themselves.
Well, yeah, I think that's a real problem. Did anybody catch that? That people have a hard time with enthusiasm versus self-promotion. They really don't want to appear as promoting themselves too much. I know that's actually an issue, particularly in science, because you don't want to actually be taking, because science builds on so much the work of so many others, you do not want to appear to be taking credit for things. You know, you want to only take credit for the little part that you did. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes that gets lost, that subtlety. But you still really do want to work on not going into lecture mode. When I had the chance of, you know, hearing Alan Alda talk about interviewing scientists, and he said he had this one woman who kept, during the part of the interview, she kept like breaking off and going into lecture mode, and he could tell when she was going to do it because she broke eye contact, went into space, and her whole demeanor changed. She ended up with that very cool, aloof sort of thing and started like going on and on in this very didactic tone, and he would interrupt her with some sort of fun little jokey question, and she would make eye contact again and become human again and start talking to him. And he had to keep doing this because she, you know, given the chance, she lapsed into what was most comfortable for her. That is perfectly normal. We all have our comfort zones, and the only way we grow is to get out of it. I used to be painfully, painfully shy. Public speaking would have been unthinkable for me 15 years ago, and now I do it quite frequently. I still get nervous, I still make mistakes, but I'm far, far less terrified of it because at some point I pushed myself out of my comfort zone and became comfortable with something new. And that's what I think more and more scientists, I think, need to do. A lot of the reason for the interactive nature of some of the things that I'm doing are for that reason, to kind of get us all out of our comfort zone, what we're comfortable doing, so that we can actually become better communicators. Okay, take time to breathe before answering the questions. You don't want to just jump right into it. It's also a good idea to repeat or paraphrase them before answering. You want to make sure that you actually understood the question. My husband speaks a lot to the media, and he basically learned early on that sometimes he anticipates a question and starts to answer it, and it turns out it's not the one he anticipated. So it ends, you know, he's learned to just kind of really listen to the question and take a moment and really think about it, and if there's any kind of, and sometimes repeat it back or paraphrase it back, just to make sure everybody's on the same page. Now, I said not to answer hypothetical or speculative questions, but also, you know, avoid saying no comment. It gives the wrong impression. It gives the impression that you're trying to hide something, and I think in science you're not. It's simply sometimes you just simply can't answer the question for policy reasons, national security, a legal matter, or explaining it would just take 30 minutes, and you don't have 30 minutes. That's actually very valid, I think probably the most valid when it comes to physics, and I suggest if you get a question like that, I could explain it to you, but you know it's going to take some time, and if you would like to sit down with me afterwards, we can schedule a time and I will sit there and walk you through it. It's just going to take 20 or 30 minutes. Just let them know that you're happy to answer it, but you can't do it right there because it's just a little complicated. Don't say anything off the record. You think that that's the whole point of a press conference is to be on the record. Invariably, scientists say their best stuff and then claim it's off the record. And don't assume that anything you say to a journalist is going to be off the record even after the press conference ends, unless you very specifically say that. I have to be careful. I always warn scientists to be careful because even though, you know, I have good friends who are scientists and that sort of thing, when I'm interviewing, I can't interview good friends who are scientists for conflict of interest reasons, but don't assume the journalist is your pal, even if they're friendly, even if you're kind of hitting it off, because they're there to do a job. And chances are you might say something that gives something away that you wish you hadn't, and they will report it. And then you're going to feel kind of betrayed. And you'll never be friends again. Now, I don't do this, but I know reporters that do. They will occasionally ask loaded questions. If Greg Easterbrook shows up and starts asking you whether or not string theory supports intelligent design and arguing that quarks don't have content, don't let him get away with it. Challenge him, correct the errors. And don't respond to a loaded question as if it were legitimate. Basically say that's really not a legitimate question and explain why. If they are on the wrong track, and that becomes very obvious when they're asking questions, it's very, very clear they have misunderstood something very, very fundamental, make that very, very clear. This is your chance, the only chance you may get, unless they happen to call you for a follow-up, to make sure that these fundamental misunderstandings don't creep in. They often will, but our goal here is to reduce that as much as possible. A good press conference, short and sweet. Make your points in 10 minutes. Don't bore reporters with too many technical details. Further details should be provided by handout materials. And the graphics can be useful, but they must be good graphics that help convey information because, as we noted earlier, a bad graphic can do more harm than good. This actually happens to me all the time because I go to scientific press conferences at actual meetings. So you've got an interesting combination there of very, very science-savvy reporters, many of them with that master's or PhD degrees in science or physics, who are writing for Nature, for Science or Physics Today. And then you've got people from USA Today who just got stuck with the science beat and really don't know the first thing about what they're covering. They've just kind of been thrown to the wolves, and their editor said, here, go cover it. It's a science meeting. Find an angle. And then you've got people in between who are like me, who have been following this for several years and do have some background, but do not have actual degrees. Now, this always used to bug me because invariably there would be one person, one reporter, who felt the need to show off his great knowledge and grasp of the material by asking a very, very detailed technical question. It was always a guy, I don't know why. And what would happen invariably was the scientist's eyes would light up. Oh, thank God, someone I can talk to on my own level. And the level of discourse would just shoot right up and suddenly it would be this huge technical thing. And the irony being that I would look at the reporter and I would know that even though he had a degree, he wasn't following anybody. He would just be nodding sagely and writing things down. It's like, I actually went up to someone who did that one too many times and said, could you please save that for after the press conference? You know, because, you know, the USA Today person and the local newspaper reporter, now we're not going to get coverage for this because you felt the need to ask this highly detailed technical question in a public press conference when you could have just taken the guy aside as a colleague and set up a longer interview. And as the presenter, you can actually take control of that situation. I was at a physics colloquium last week, or 2 weeks ago, in Broida Hall, where someone in the audience asked the speaker a very, very detailed question. Now, the colloquia are designed specifically for like an undergraduate physics major level, maybe graduate tops. And the moderator basically just said, that's a very technical, detailed question, and I recommend that you take it up with our speaker afterwards, and so that we don't take this away from the students. It was a wonderful, nice gesture, a really great way of handling it. The guy can still get his answer questioned, still get his question answered, but the students don't miss out by suddenly having the level of discourse go over their heads. Keep slides to a minimum. I've been at more than one press conference where the people just went through slide after slide after slide of incomprehensible equations and diagrams and fuzzy charts. This is from the woman at JLab. She basically just said no more than three slides for a 15-minute talk. That's pretty much, you know, so one per 4 to 5 minutes of talking, you want one of those slides. You also don't want to acknowledge every colleague during the news conference. This is good scientific manners to acknowledge your colleagues, but some of these are very, very elaborate collaborations. The best thing to do, rather than have it be right there during the press conference, is to list everyone in the briefing materials. And you've got like one last slide, maybe, that you leave on the screen during the Q&A, and you can list all your collaborators with like the group picture or something. That way, everybody's happy. You get the information out there, you acknowledge your collaborators, but you don't kind of get hung up during the actual conference on that. Apparently, I mean, we've all been to talks more than once where the slides just got way out of hand, and that actually goes for PowerPoint presentations, you know, for technical audiences as well. And finally, rehearse, preferably via a mock press conference, which is what we're going to do next. I'm going to actually, you know, invite a couple of people to come up here and give like a 10-minute presentation of, say, their latest research results, you know, the paper they've just finished, what they work on and why it's relevant. Because we had to get out of our comfort zone, because you need to actually try it and get up here and talk and see just how hard it is to sum this up. See, we're already losing someone. I knew I should have locked the doors before I did this. We're going to switch over to that aspect for the last half hour, and hopefully someone will volunteer. I do want to say that the last slide here are some additional online resources. Some of these points were taken from them, and some of them, and they also offer additional input. You might find it interesting. These PowerPoint slides are posted online, along with the taped version of the talk. So if in the future you want to look them up, that's what they're there. And I'm just going to leave that up. And now, we actually have a student reporter here to help me out, Sabrina. She covers science for the Nexus. She and I are going to be playing the reporters, and we need someone, a scientist or someone, to come up and talk about their research. You got 10 minutes, and obviously this is not going to be perfect because you haven't had time to prepare and you don't have your graphics and stuff. The idea is to get you comfortable trying to talk in this very abbreviated format and pick out your main points. Is there anyone who would care to come up? You get to put on the little microphone and everything. Nobody? Which means that we're probably going to have to end early because you're all cowards.
Tom.
Tom who?
Tom Prince.
Tom Prince has been volunteered. You posted those wonderful pictures, actually, on the KITP blog of KITP in the infrared.
Yes.
Why don't you come up and tell us about those? Seriously. I assume that we do not know anything about infrared or photography or the KITP, and you can talk a little bit about what's going on in those pictures and what makes us look in a different way at how KITP works in those lenses. And they're running.
Yeah, so first of all, this is going to be difficult because I'm not necessarily a good impromptu speaker. I like to be prepared when I speak. Let's see. So, give me a couple of seconds.
Sure.
I'll have a dead air.
You don't mind dead air?
Dead air, yeah.
Do you have the photos on the web somewhere?
Actually, you do.
So I'll have graphics.
Yeah, let me give you some graphics.
They're actually much better when you have them in high resolution.
Yeah. So now we have visuals.
Okay, very good. Okay, so I started on this project as a scientist. I took a camera, I got it modified. Okay, it's a standard little digital snapshot camera, just like everyone uses. Okay, except that the camera that you use has a little filter on it that takes and blocks everything except what we see. So I said, what happens if you take away that filter that blocks everything you see, take it away, put on a filter that then allows you to see everything else that was blocked? Okay, so that was my experiment. And I approached it as a scientist, and the first thing I did was I took pictures of stop signs and flowers and, you know, cars and headlights and so forth. But then I started to find out that these pictures were really interesting. And so the pictures then that I started shooting are just outside where we can see them in the visible range. Okay? So just outside, they're just a little bit red on the red side of where we see them. Okay, and when you start then taking these pictures with a standard digital camera, just like all of you use, you find a very different perspective. And so a couple of things. One is that, I don't know if anybody notices any differences there. These are, by the way, totally undoctored photos. They're just as they come right off the camera. So first of all, obviously the sky is black. And why is that? The sky is blue, and if you shoot towards the red, the sky isn't red, so there's no light from the sky is black. Here you can see a shot out of the turret outside of KITP, and you immediately notice that all the trees are not dark and green and nice, where they normally are, but they're all very reflective, and you can see that here in the palm tree. So almost all vegetation, living vegetation then, is essentially white when you photograph just outside the visible range. Other things then is that the shadows are very different, and this is something that's very subtle. It's something that you aren't aware of when you look at the pictures, but it definitely affects you and makes the pictures look a little bit surreal, is that there's no blue sky, so the shadows aren't washed out. So shadows are very sharp, very crisp, in fact, incredibly crisp. And the overall effect then, when you see these in high, especially in high resolution, it's a world that you're very familiar with, but it looks very, very different. And I think the appealing thing then is that it's actually real, they're real pictures. They're what you would see if your eyes were just a little bit different than the ones we had, but they're very common objects that we're very familiar with.
Questions? And once again, anything else? Yes?
Were there animals that seen that range?
That's a question that I've been asked several times, and I haven't looked up the answer yet, or I haven't researched the answer. It's a good question. I can answer that technically later.
I'll answer it.
So,
it plays to define the infrared.
Right. So our eyes, see out to about, it's just outside the visible band. I'm not prepared to say. let me just tell you a short answer as a scientist. It's a one which is about 800 nanometers. Actually, I use an 830 nanometer filter.
I'm looking more at the case of that's around infrared because there are little shrimp at the bottom of the ocean that's seen infrared. They don't have eyes, they have like eye patches on the backs, and they can see the hot vents coming out, like, you know, that are on volcanic ridges. So it's theorized that some snakes actually sense heat.
This is not heat. First of all, so that's an important point, is that heat is about another, so if this is that one wavelength, heat is about three times on the wavelength. So it's way outside the range that your digital camera would sense. So this is just a little bit beyond this.
Is this an experiment that anybody could duplicate with their own camera easily?
Yes, they can. So I had a gun because I wanted to shoot fairly high quality pictures. The problem is that when you do this, you know, there's, you can get dust on the sensor. You can get dust on a lot of things, and so you'd rather do it in a clean room. And so at some point here, I want to take an old digital camera and just take it apart and do the operation. But I didn't do it on this one.
You're not using film, but...
Well, this is kind of standard digital camera, so it's one you can go and buy in the store.
But the receptors somehow are sensitive to these wavelengths?
All of the cameras are sensitive to these wavelengths. Normally, there's a filter there that blocks these wavelengths. And all you have to do is just take that filter away, put in one that blocks all the visible, and you're in this.
Yeah. How much does it cost to change the camera? Like apart from labor.
So if you do it just with a company, it costs about $200, $250 to modify it. If you bought the camera and sent it in, you'd pay about $250.
When you say that you're using film, are you real pictures if your eyes are just a little bit different? Do you think like if our eyes could see the infrared wavelength?
That's correct. So if our eyes could see infrared but not visible, this is what we would see. Well, one clarification of that is these are black and white pictures because the filter that is on the camera is only one filter. If we put three different filters on there that would be the equivalent of red, green, and say blue, then we would see a color picture in this one. But what there is just one filter on there, but just it was black, essentially black.
Have you experimented with the color version of this? Because I'm curious, because you went into great detail about the black and white, the shadows were sharper, you had like a black sky. But what happened to the colors in the infrared?
I don't know that exactly. Because I have other filters, but then I can take the same picture and read different filters and then start making the color. But I haven't done that. It's been interesting enough just in the black. Mm-hmm.
Is your first exhibition?
Interestingly enough, I've shot quite often, probably about 1,000 pictures now. Very many up around Santa Barbara, the Mesa. And if anyone comes by and my screensaver is operating, you'll see all the pictures.
So are there any practical applications? She's playing devil's advocate.
So the answer is yes. So let's say you might want to do look at traffic in a crowded or in an area where there's lots of trees. This helps discriminate man-made objects from non-man-made objects. So I can imagine some sort of robot, say, that have to do some kind of operation, or vehicle avoidance or something like that. I could imagine that it might want to operate partially in this range rather than in the range, you know, the way we see. But I don't know that for sure.
Well, I think we can thank you. Thank you so much.
Tom is a trooper.
And notice that this was not necessarily a big, scary physics result. This is like a personal hobby, something he did for fun that has a very strong science component. And immediately, you could all connect to it. You had questions that were relevant. You know, he got a chance to actually define infrared, and he made it, you know, made it very clear to make that the distinction that this is not the same thing as heat, because many people sometimes just equate infrared automatically with heat. You've got a beautiful graphic here that he could build on. Got a nice story of how he took your standard everyday camera. Everybody kind of knows what a digital camera is, and he just kind of doctored it a little bit, and he got this. So that's a nice little science story. And he did it all in 10, 15 minutes in a short press conference. And I'm not going to, if someone else wants to come up and give it a shot, they are certainly welcome. But I think that we have, if nothing else, demonstrated, you know, exactly how this works, the kinds of things that connect with people. It's much harder when you're dealing with a very obscure topic in theoretical physics. I remember when I mentioned that the COBE results won the 2006 Nobel Prize. Well, of course, another Nobel Prize shared by our own David Gross was on quantum chromodynamics, you know, quark color theory. And all the science journalists were tearing out their hair going, how the hell are we going to explain this to a public? It was extremely difficult. And they came up with all kinds of weird little analogies and odd ways of trying to visualize it. And the Nobel Prize committee just gave up and just kind of says, yeah, well, this is what it is, and, you know, deal with it. But they did a, you know, Nobel Prize Foundation actually does very, very well with their press, because they have a technical background, and then they also have a more human interest general public release. Then they have a lot of biographical information, and sometimes they will have actual interviews with the scientists. Their website is, you know, depends on the scientists and how much time they have, but their website can be a lot of fun to browse for that very reason as they start adding things. Anyone else?
Not I want to do it, but I want to say one of the things that made it such an enjoyable exchange is that the enthusiasm for what he was talking about was as clear as what he was describing. Mm-hmm. And people who devote their lives to research and publishing science feel very strongly about those, and they tend to not relax into them when they talk to the public.
Right.
Which is a loss of enthusiasm, and it's harder to identify.
This was a real easy topic.
Yeah.
Because the other thing I could talk about is mergers of black holes, and that gets tougher quicker.
But people love black holes, and then they merge, and it's just, you know, I actually think you could get a lot of play out of that, but you're right, it would be much, much harder to, you'd want to have some, yeah, you would want some prep time for that. But this kind of gave you an idea of what you can do on very, very short notice with a very simple topic in science. And had there been someone here who had no scientific background, they would have thought this was totally cool. I have nieces and nephews who are in high school who just think this would be the coolest thing ever. And so don't underestimate your own hobbies. One of the reasons I became a science writer was not because I took really exciting physics courses, because I didn't. I started working for the American Physical Society and talking to physicists, and it was their enthusiasm and their passion and their love for their subject that came out when I was talking to them one-on-one. And when I started attending press conferences, I was shocked to see these same people, as you say, get up and suddenly become very dry and technical and didactic and just not aware. I remember going up to one guy and saying, you know, we were just talking about this at dinner overnight, and you didn't tell this one story. And why didn't you tell that story? And he ended up using that in a later conversation with the reporter, and of course it made the article. Absolutely. So we are going to end early unless someone else wants to try and give this a go. I know that it's hard when, you know, you haven't had a chance to prepare. But thank you all for coming, and I hope that you found this useful and relevant. And should your press information officer in the future ask you to participate in a press conference, you will have time to prepare, and hopefully you'll have some useful tips. Thank you. Thank you for all not running.